ball into the palm of his hand and peered at it, then made an irritable noise. His glasses were fogged with the sweat of his efforts. Jamie snatched them off the Quaker's nose and rubbed them hastily on his shirt tail, replacing them before Hunter could blink twice.
"I thank thee," Denny said mildly, returning his attention to the musket ball.
He turned it delicately and let out an audible breath.
"Ho," he said. "Thank God." "Deo gracias,"
Jamie echoed fervently and reached out a hand.
"Let me see it, will you?"
Hunter's brows rose, but he dropped the thing in Jamie's hand. It was startlingly warm, warm from her body. Warmer even than the air, or Jamie's own sweating flesh, and the feel of it made him fold his fist over it. He stole a look at Claire's chest, rising, falling, though with alarming slowness. Almost as slowly, he opened his hand.
"What is he looking for, Jamie?"
Denny asked, pausing to re-sterilize his beaked probe.
"Marks? A slit? A cross? Any mark of tampering?"
He rolled the ball carefully between his fingers, then relaxed, a small spurt of gratitude making him murmur, "Deo gracias," again.
"Tampering?"
There were vertical lines between Denny's brows, deepening as he looked up.
"To make the ball fragment, thee means. That, or worse? Sometimes a man will rub something into the marks, poison, say, or shit, just in case the wound itself isn't a fatal, aye?"
Hunter looked shocked, his appalled expression clear even behind the shielding handkerchief.
"If you mean to kill a man, you mean him harm," Jamie said dryly. "Yes, but..."
Hunter looked down, laying his tool carefully on the towel as though it were made of porcelain, not metal. His breath fluttered the handkerchief tied over his mouth.
"But it is one thing, surely, to kill in battle, to shoot at an enemy when it's a matter of one's own life, and to form the cold-blooded intent that your enemy should die a horrible and lingering death."
Claire made a ghastly moaning noise and twitched under his hands as Denny gently squeezed the flesh on either side of the wound. Jamie gripped her by the elbows to keep her from turning. Denny picked up the jawed thing again.
"You wouldn't do it yourself," Hunter said with certainty.
His eyes were intent on his delicate probing, a pledget held to catch the blood that dribbled slowly from the wound. Jamie felt the loss of each drop, as though it left his own veins, and felt cold.
How much could she lose and still live? "No, it would be a cowardly thing."
But he spoke automatically, scarcely attending. She had gone limp. He saw her fingers uncurl, droop, and looked at her face, her throat, searching for a visible pulse. He felt one in his thumb where it pressed the bone of her arm, but couldn't tell whether it was her heart that beat there, or his own. He was acutely conscious of Denny's breath, audible behind his mask. It stopped for an instant, and Jamie glanced up from his scrutiny of Claire's face to see the Quaker's look of intentness as he drew the thing free once more, this time clutching a tiny clump of something unrecognizable. Denny opened the jaws of his forceps and dropped the clump on the towel, then used the tool to poke at it, trying to spread it, and Jamie saw the prickle of tiny dark threads as the blood soaked away into a bright red stain on the towel. Cloth.
"What does thee think?" Denny asked him, frowning at the thing. "Is it a bit of her shift, or the bodice, or material from her stays? For, from the hole in her stays, I should think..."
Jamie rootled hastily in his sporran, pulling out the little silk bag in which he kept the spectacles he used for reading, and clapped these on his nose.
"You've at least two separate bits there,"
he announced, after an anxious perusal.
"Canvas from the stays and a lighter bit of cloth, see?"
He took up a probe and delicately teased the fragments apart.
"I think that one bit's her shift."
Denny glanced at the disconsolate pile of blood-stained garments on the floor, and Jamie, at once divining his intent, reached in, stirred about, and pulled out the remnants of her dress.
"It's a clean hole," Denny said, looking at the fabric Jamie spread out on the table. "Maybe."
He picked up the forceps and turned back, not finishing. More probing, deeper, and Jamie gritted his teeth not to cry out in protest.
"The liver is so vascular," she'd said, talking Denny through what he must do. "The risk of hemorrhage." "I know," Denny murmured, not looking up.
The sweat had plastered the handkerchief to his face, moulding itself to nose and lips, so his speech was visible.
"I'm being careful." "Can that," Jamie said,
but so softly he didn't know whether Hunter heard him.
"Please, please let her live. Blessed Mother, save her. Save her, save her, save her."
The words all ran together in an instant, and he lost the sense of them, but not the sense of desperate entreaty. The red stain on the toweling under her had grown to alarming proportions by the time Hunter set down his tool again and sighed, shoulders slumping.
"I think, I hope, I have it all." "Good. What will you do next?"
He saw Denny smile a little behind the sodden cloth. Olive brown eyes soft and steady over it.
"Cauterize it. Bind the wound. And pray, Jamie."
Chapter 84. Nightfall. It was past dark when Lord John Grey, accompanied by a respectful escort and a slightly damaged Indian, limped into Clinton's camp. Things were much as might be expected after a battle, strong currents of mingled agitation and exhaustion, the latter prevailing. No carousing amid the tents, no music. Men around the fires and camp kitchens, though, eating, getting themselves sorted, tongued over in low tones. No sense of celebration, more a sense of irritation, of disgruntled surprise. The scent of roast mutton came strongly through the smells of dust, mules, and sweating humanity, and Grey's mouth watered so much that he had to swallow before replying to Captain André's solicitous inquiry as to his immediate desires.
"I need to see my brother," he replied. "I'll attend upon General Clinton and my Lord Cornwallis later." "When I've washed and changed," he added, shucking the horrible black coat for what he sincerely hoped was the last time. André nodded understandingly, taking the vile garment from him. "Of course, Lord John, and,
He nodded delicately in the direction of Ian Murray, who was attracting glances, if not stares, from passers-by.
"Ah, he'd best come too."
He followed André through the orderly aisles of tents, hearing the clinking of mess kits and feeling the comfort of the army's stolid routine settle into place around him. Murray paced at his heel, silent. He'd no idea what the man was thinking and was too weary to care. He did feel Murray's step falter, though, and automatically looked over his shoulder. Murray had turned, all his attention focused on a nearby fire. This, an open wood fire, around which sat several Indians. Grey wondered dimly whether these might be friends of Murray's, and corrected this impression in the next second, as Murray took three giant strides, grabbed one of the Indians with a forearm round his throat, and punched him in the side with such force as to drive the other's wind out in an audible whoop. Murray then threw the Indian on the ground, dropped on him with both knees. Grey winced at the impact, and gripped the man by the throat. The other Indians lurched out of the way, laughing and making high-pitched yips of encouragement or derision. Grey couldn't tell which. He stood there, blinking, swaying slightly, and unable either to intervene or to look away. Murray had declined to let one of the field surgeons remove the arrowhead from his shoulder, and fresh blood spattered from the wound as he punched his opponent viciously and repeatedly in the face. The Indian, he had a shaved scalp and dangling earrings of shell. Grey noticed these when Murray ripped one out of the ear and stuffed it into his opponent's mouth, was making a stout attempt at resistance and retaliation in spite of his being taken at such a disadvantage.
Do you suppose they're acquainted? Captain André asked Grey. He had turned back, hearing the outcries, and was now standing beside Grey, watching the affray with interest.
I think they must be, Grey replied absently.
He glanced briefly at the other Indians, none of whom appeared to have any interest in assisting their fellow, though a few of them appeared to be making wagers on the result. They'd plainly been drinking, but seemed no more intoxicated than the average soldier at this time of day. The combatants were now squirming on the ground, evidently striving for possession of a large knife worn by the man Murray had attacked. The fight was attracting attention from other quarters. A number of men had hurried over from nearby fires and were clustered behind Grey and André, making speculations and hasty bets, offering shouted advice. Grey was conscious, through his fatigue, of a certain concern for Murray, and not only on Murray's own account. On the off chance that he might at some point in future actually speak with Jamie Fraser again, he didn't want the first subject raised to be the demise of Fraser's nephew, while more or less in Grey's custody. He couldn't think what the hell to do about it, though, and thus continued to stand there, watching. Like most fights, it didn't last very long. Murray gained possession of the knife by the brutal but effective expedient of bending one of his opponent's fingers backward till it broke, and grabbing the hilt as the man let go. As Murray pressed the blade against the other man's throat, it belatedly occurred to Grey that he might really intend to kill him. The men around him certainly thought so. There was a universal gasp as Murray drew the blade across his enemy's throat. The momentary silence engendered by this was enough for most of the assembled to hear Murray say, with a noticeable effort,
"I give you back your life."
He rose off the Indian's body, swaying and staring as though blind drunk himself, and hurled the knife into the darkness, causing considerable consternation and not a little cursing among those in whose direction he'd hurled it. In the excitement, most of the crowd likely didn't hear the Indian's reply, but Grey and André did. He sat up, very slowly, hands shaking as they pressed a fold of his shirt to the shallow cut across his throat, and said, in an almost conversational tone, "You will regret that, Mohawk." Murray was breathing like a winded horse, his ribs visible with each gasp. Most of the paint had gone from his face. There were long smears of red and black down his glistening chest, and only a horizontal streak of some dark colour remained across his cheekbones. That, and a smudge of white on the point of his shoulder, above the arrow wound. He nodded to himself, once, then twice. And without haste, stepped back into the circle of firelight, picked up a tomahawk that was lying on the ground, and, swinging it high with both hands, brought it down on the Indian's skull. The sound froze Grey to the marrow, and silenced every man present. Murray stood still for a moment, breathing heavily, then walked away. As he passed Grey, he turned his head and said, in a perfectly conversational tone of voice,
"He's right. I would have."
Before disappearing into the night. There was a sudden belated stir among the spectators, and André glanced at Grey, but he shook his head. The army took no official notice of what went on among the Indian scouts, save there was an incident involving regulars. And they didn't get more irregular than the gentleman who had just left them. André cleared his throat.
"Was he your, prisoner, my lord?"
No. Relation by marriage."
"Oh, I see."
It was full dark before the battle ended. William gathered as much from the orderly who'd brought him supper, and he could hear the sounds of a camp slowly reassembling itself as companies of soldiers came in, were dismissed, and scattered to drop their equipment and find food. Nothing like the usual sense of relaxation that lay on a camp after sunset. Everything was agitated and restless, And so was William. His head ached horribly, and someone had stitched his scalp. The stitches were tender and itching. Uncle Hal hadn't come back, and he'd had no news whatever beyond the orderly's sketchy report, which indicated only that there had been no clear victory over the Americans, but that all three parts of Clinton's army had withdrawn in good order, though with considerable casualties. He wasn't sure he wanted any further news, to be honest. There was going to be a moment of reckoning with Sir Henry about that ignored order, though he supposed Sir Henry might just possibly be too preoccupied to realise. Then he heard the sound of footsteps and sat up. His fretting disappeared on the instant when the tent flap lifted, and he saw his father. Lord John, he corrected himself, but as an absent afterthought. His father seemed surprisingly small, almost fragile, and as Lord John limped slowly into the lantern light, William saw the stained bandage round his head, the makeshift sling. And when William cast his eyes down, he saw, too, the state of his father's bare feet.
"Are you—"
he began, shocked, but Lord John interrupted him.
"I'm fine,"
he said, and tried for a smile, though his face was white and creased with fatigue.
"Everything's all right, Willie, as long as you're alive. Everything's all right."
He saw his father sway, put out a hand as though to steady himself, and finding nothing to take hold of, withdraw it and force his body upright. Lord John's voice was hoarse, and his exposed eye bloodshot and exhausted, but tender. William swallowed.
"If you and I have things to say to each other, Willie, and of course we do, let it wait until tomorrow. Please, I'm not—"
He made a vague, wavering gesture that ended nowhere. The lump in William's throat was sudden and painful. He nodded, hands clenched tight in the bedding. His father nodded too, drew a deep breath, and turned toward the tent flap, where William saw Uncle Hal was hovering, eyes fixed on his brother, and brows drawn with worry. William's heart seized in a lump more painful than the one in his throat.
"Papa?"
His father stopped abruptly, turning to look over his shoulder.
"I'm glad you're not dead," William blurted.
A smile blossomed slowly on his father's battered face.
"Me too,"
he said. Ian made his way out of the British camp, looking neither to right nor to left. The night was throbbing slowly round him. It was like being trapped inside a huge heart, he thought, feeling the thick walls squeeze him breathless, then draw away to leave him floating and weightless. Lord John had offered to have an army surgeon tend his wound, but he couldn't bear to stay. He needed to go, to find Rachel, find Uncle Jamie. Had refused the offer of a horse as well, unsure that he could stay on it.
"He'd do better walking," he told his lordship.
And he was walking all right, though obliged to admit that he didn't feel just that well in himself. His arms were still trembling from the shock of the killing blow. It had come up from his bowels and was still echoing through his bones. Couldn't seem to find a way out of his body.
"Well, it would settle soon enough." This wasn't the first time.
Though he hadn't killed anyone in a long while, and a longer while since he'd done it with that much violence. He tried to think who the last one had been, but couldn't. He could hear and see and feel things, but while his senses worked, they weren't joined up aright with the things he sensed. Troops were still marching past him into the camp. The battle must have ceased now with the darkness. The soldiers were coming home. He could hear the din they made, marching, their tin cups and canteens jangling against their cartridge boxes. But he heard it clanging long after they'd passed, and he couldn't always tell the light of distant campfires from the glow of fireflies near his feet.
"The Scottish overseer at Saratoga.
The man's face was suddenly there in his memory, and just as suddenly his body remembered the feel of the blow. The violent punch of his knife, hard up under the man's back ribs, straight into the kidney. The huge, strange flexing he'd felt in his own body as the man's life surged up and then rushed out. He wondered for a dazed moment whether butchers felt it, that echo, when they slaughtered a beast. You did, sometimes, when you cut a deer's throat, but usually not if it was just wringing a chicken's neck or crushing a weasel's skull.
"Or maybe you just get used to it," he said.
"Maybe you'd best try not to get used to it. Can't it be good for your soul, Avalach, being used to that sort of thing?"
"No," he agreed. "But you mean when it's with your hands, aye? It's no the same with a gun or an arrow now, is it?"
"Och, no. I did wonder sometimes, does it make a difference to the man you kill, as well as yourself?"
Ian's feet blundered into a knee-high growth of thick weed, and he realized that he'd stumbled off the road. It was just past the dark of the moon, and the stars still faint overhead.
"Different,"
he murmured, staring back into the roadway.
"How do you mean, different? He'd be dead either way." "Aye, that's so. I'm thinking it's maybe worse to feel it's personal, though. Being shot in battle's more like being struck by lightning, Ken. But you canna help it being personal when you do a man to death with your hands."
Ian walked a bit farther in silence, the thoughts in his head circling like leeches swimming in a glass, going this way and that.
"Aye, well,"
he said at last, and realized suddenly that he'd spoken aloud for the first time.
"It was personal."
The trembling in his bones had eased with the walking. The huge throbbing of the night had shrunk, and come to rest in the arrow wound, the ache of it pulsing to the beat of his own heart. It made him think of Rachel's white dove, though, flying serene above the hurt, and his mind steadied. He could see Rachel's face now, and he could hear crickets chirping. The cannon fire in his ears had stopped, and the night grew slowly peaceful. And if his Da had more to say on the subject of killing, he chose to keep his silence as they walked toward home together. John Gray eased his battered feet into the pan, teeth gritted against the expected sensation, but to his surprise found that it caused him little pain, in spite of the torn skin and ruptured blisters.
"What? That's not hot water, is it?" he asked, leaning forward to look. "Sweet oil," his brother said, his worn face relaxing a little. "And it had better be warm, not hot, or my orderly will be crucified at dawn. I'm sure the man trembles in his boots. Thank you, by the way," he added, gingerly dabbling.
He was sitting on Hal's cot, his brother perched on the campaign chest, pouring something out of a canteen into one of the scarred pewter cups that had accompanied him for decades.
"You're welcome," Hal said, handing him the cup. "What the devil happened to your eye? And is your arm broken? I've called for a surgeon, but it may be some time."
He waved a hand, encompassing the camp, the recent battle, and the stream of the returning wounded and sun-stricken.
"I don't need one. At first I thought my arm was broken, but I'm fairly sure it's just badly bruised. As for the eye? Jamie Fraser." "Really?"
Hal looked surprised and bent forward to peer at Gray's eye, now unwrapped from the bandages, and, so far as Gray himself could tell, much improved. The constant watering had stopped, the swelling had gone down quite a bit, and he could, with caution, move it. From the look on Hal's face, though, the redness and bruising had perhaps not quite disappeared.
"Well, first Jamie, and then his wife."
He touched the eye lightly.
"He punched me, and then she did something excruciating to fix it, and put honey in it. Having been subject to the lady's notions of medical treatment, I'm not even faintly surprised to hear that."
Hal lifted his cup in brief salute. Gray did the same,
and they drank. It was cider, and a dim recollection of Applejack and Colonel Watson Smith floated through Grey's mind. Both seemed remote, as though they'd happened years ago, rather than days.
"Mrs. Fraser doctored you?"
Grey grinned at his brother.
"What did she do to you?"
"Well, save my life, to be perfectly frank."
It was hard to tell in the lantern light, but Grey thought his brother was blushing slightly.
"Oh, in that case I'm doubly obliged to her."
He raised the cup again ceremoniously, then drained it. The cider went down gratefully after a hot day with no food.
"How the hell did you fall into her clutches?"
he asked curiously, extending the cup for more.
"I was looking for you,"
Hal said pointedly.
"If you'd been where you were supposed to be..."
"You think I'm supposed to be sitting somewhere waiting for you to turn up without warning and involve me in..."
"Do you know you nearly got me hanged?"
"Besides, I was busy being kidnapped by James Fraser at the time."
Hal raised one eyebrow and poured more cider.
"Yes, you did say he'd punched you. What for?"
Grey rubbed two fingers between his brows. He hadn't really noticed the headache before, only because he'd had it all day. Hal was definitely making it worse, though.
"I couldn't begin to explain it, Hal," he said tiredly. "Can you find me a bed? I think I'm going to die, and if by some unfortunate chance I don't, I'll have to speak to Willie tomorrow about... well, never mind."
He drank the last of the cider and set down the cup, preparing reluctantly to lift his feet from the soothing oil.
"I know about William," Hal said.
Grey stopped abruptly, looking dubiously at his brother, who shrugged.
"I saw Fraser," he said simply, "in Philadelphia. And when I said something to William this afternoon, he confirmed it."
"Did he?" Grey murmured. He was surprised, but somewhat heartened by that. If Willie had calmed down sufficiently as to talk to Hal about the matter, Grey's own conversation with his son might be a trifle less fraught than he'd feared.
"How long have you known?"
Hal asked curiously.
"For certain. Since Willie was 2 or 3.
He suddenly gave an enormous yawn, then sat blinking stupidly.
"Oh, meant to ask. How did the battle go?"
Hal looked at him with something between affront and amusement.
"You were bloody in it, weren't you?" "My part of it didn't go that well. But my perspective was somewhat limited by circumstance. That, and having only one working eye," he added, gently prodding the bad one.
A good night's sleep. Longing for bed made him sway narrowly, catching himself before simply falling into Hal's cot.
"Hard to tell."
Hal fished a crumpled towel out of a basket of laundry lurking disreputably in the corner, and, kneeling down, lifted Grey's feet out of the oil and blotted them gently.
"Hell of a mess. Terrible ground, chopped up by creeks, either farmland or half-covered in trees. Sir Henry got away with a baggage train and refugees all safe. But as for Washington..."
He shrugged.
"So far as I can tell from what I saw and heard, his troops acquitted themselves well. Remarkably well," he added thoughtfully.
He rose to his feet.
"Lie down, John. I'll find a bed somewhere else."
Grey was much too tired to argue. He simply fell over and rolled onto his back, not bothering to undress. The bad eye felt gritty, and he wondered dimly whether to ask Hal to find some honey, but decided that could wait till morning. Hal took the lantern from its hook and turned toward the tent flap, but paused for an instant, turning back.
"Do you think Mrs. Fraser... By the way, tomorrow I want to know how on earth she came to marry you. Do you think she knows about William and James Fraser?"
"Anyone with eyes had seen the two of them would know," Grey murmured, eyes half closed.
She never mentioned it, though.
Hal grunted.
Apparently, everyone knew, save William. Little wonder he's...
That's one word for it.
I hadn't found one yet.
Does it matter? Gray's eyes closed all the way. Through the drifting mists of sleep, he heard Hal's quiet voice by the tent flap.
I've had word of Ben. They say he's dead.
Chapter 85. Long Road Home. Jamie sat by the tiny window in his shirt and breeches, watching his wife's hair dry. It was hot as a forge in the tiny spare room Mrs. Macken had given them, and his sweat lay on him in a heavy dew that broke under its own weight and ran down his sides with any movement, but he was careful not to block any faint breath of air that might seep into the room. The air reeked of Roquefort cheese and blood. He'd soaked her hair with the water from the ewer Mrs. Macken had brought and wetted her shift. It clung to her body, the round of her buttock showing pink through the fabric as it dried. It showed the thick wad of the dressing, too, and the bloody stain that spread slow upon the cloth. Slow. His lips formed the word, and he thought it passionately, but didn't speak aloud. Slow. Stopping altogether would be much better, but he'd settle for slow just now. 8 pints. That's how much blood, she said, a human body had. It must vary some, though. Clearly a man his size had more than a woman of hers. Single hairs were beginning to rise from the soaking mass, curling as they dried, delicate as an ant's feelers. He wished he might give her some of his blood. He had plenty. She said it was possible, but not in this time. Something to do with things in the blood that mightn't match. Her hair was a dozen colours, brown, molasses, cream and butter, sugar, sable. Gleams of gold and silver where the dying light touched it. A broad streak of pure white at her temple, nearly the shade of her skin. She lay on her side facing him, one hand curled against her bosom, the other loose, upturned, so the inside of her wrist showed pure white too. The blue veins heartbreaking. She'd said she thought of cutting her wrists when she believed him dead. He didn't think he'd do it that way, if she died. He'd seen it. Toby Quinn with his wrist cut to the bone and all his blood run out across the floor, the room stinking of butchery, and the word fiend written on the wall above him in blood. His confession. A tithe to hell, it meant. And he shuddered in spite of the heat and crossed himself. She said it was maybe the blood that had made young Ian's bairns all die. The blood not matching betwixt him and his Mohawk wife. And that maybe it would be different with Rachel. He said a quick ave that it might be so, and crossed himself again. The hair that lay upon her shoulders was coiling now, sinuous, slow as rising bread. Ought he rouse her to drink again? She needed the water to help make more blood, to cool her with sweat. But while she slept, the pain was less. A few moments longer, then. Not now. Please, not now. She shifted, moaning, and he saw that she was different, restless now. The stain on her bandage had changed colour, darkened from scarlet to rust as it dried. He laid a hand softly on her arm and felt the heat. The bleeding had stopped. The fever had begun. Now the trees were talking to him. He wished they'd stop. The only thing Ian Murray wanted just now was silence. He was alone for the moment, but his ears buzzed and his head still throbbed with noise. That always happened for a bit after a fight. You were listening so hard to start with, for the sounds of the enemy, the direction of the wind, the voice of a saint behind you.
You began to hear the voices of the forest, like you did hunting. And then you heard the shots and shouting, and when there were moments when that stopped, you heard the blood pounding round your body and beating in your ears, and all in all, it took some time for the racket to die down afterward. He had brief flashes of things that had happened during the day. Milling soldiers, the thud of the arrow that struck him, the face of the Abenaki he'd killed by the fire, the look of George Washington on his big white horse racing up the road waving his hat. But these came and went in a fog of confusion, appearing as though revealed to him by a stroke of lightning, then disappearing into a buzzing mist. A wind went whispering through the branches over him, and he felt it on his skin as though he'd been brushed with sandpaper. What might Rachel say when he told her what he'd done? He could still hear the sound when the tomahawk caved in the Abenaki's skull. He could still feel it, too, in the bones of his arms, in the bursting pain of his wound. Dimly he realized that his feet were no longer keeping to the road. He was stumbling over clumps of grass, stubbing his moccasin-clad toes on rocks. He looked back to find his path. He saw it, plain, a wavering line of black. Why was it wavering? He didn't want silence, after all. He wanted Rachel's voice, no matter what she might say to him. It came to him dimly that he couldn't go any farther. He was aware of a faint sense of surprise, but wasn't afraid. He didn't remember falling, but found himself on the ground, his hot cheek pressed against the cool prickle of pine needles. Laboriously he got to his knees and scraped away the thick layer of fallen needles. Then he was lying with his body on damp earth, the blanket of needles half pulled over him. He could do no more, and said a brief prayer to the tree that it might protect him through the night. As he fell headlong into darkness, he did hear Rachel's voice in memory. "Thy life's journey lies along its own path, Ian," she said, "and I cannot share thy journey, but I can walk beside thee, and I will." His last thought was that he hoped she'd still mean it when he told her what he'd done. Chapter 86, in which rosy-fingered Dawn shows up mob-handed. Grey woke to the drums of reveille, not startled by the accustomed rattle, but with no clear idea where he was. In camp. Well, that much was obvious. He swung his legs out of the cot and sat up slowly, taking stock. His left arm hurt a lot. One of his eyes was stuck shut, and his mouth was so dry he could barely swallow. He'd slept in his clothes, smelt rank, and needed badly to piss. He groped under the cot, found a utensil, and used it, noting, in a rather dreamy way, that his urine smelled of apples. That brought back the taste of cider, and with it, full recollection of the day and night before. Honey and flies. Artillery. Jamie, blood down his face. Rifle butt and the crack of bone. William. Hal. Almost full recollection. He sat down and remained quite still for a moment, trying to decide whether Hal had really told him that his eldest son, Benjamin, was dead. Surely not. It must have been a shred of a nightmare lingering in his mind. And yet he had the dreadful feeling of doomed certainty that comes down like a curtain on the mind, smothering disbelief. He stood up, staggering a little, determined to go and find his brother. He hadn't yet found his shoes, though, when the flap was thrown back and Hal came in, followed by an orderly with a basin, a steaming pitcher, and shaving implements. "Sit down," Hal said in a completely ordinary voice. "You'll have to wear one of my uniforms, and you're not doing it smelling like that. What the devil happened to your hair?" Grey had forgotten his hair and flattened a palm on top of his head, surprised at the bristly stubble there. "Oh, a ruse de guerre." He sat down slowly, eyes on his brother. The bad eye had come open, though it was unpleasantly crusty, and so far as Grey could see, Hal looked much as he usually did. Tired, of course, worn, and a little haunted, but everyone looked like that the day after a battle. Surely, if it were true, he'd look different. Worse, somehow. He would have asked, but Hal didn't linger, going off and leaving John in the hands of the orderly. Before the ablutions were complete, a young Scottish surgeon with freckles appeared, yawning as though he hadn't slept all night, and blinked blearily at Grey's arm. He prodded this in a professional manner, pronounced the bone cracked but not broken, and put it in a sling. The sling had to be removed almost at once in order for him to dress. Another orderly arrived with a uniform and a tray of breakfast, and by the time he was made tidy and been forcibly fed, he was wild with impatience. He would have to wait for Hal to reappear, though. No point going out to scour the camp for him. And he really must talk to his brother before seeking out William. A small dish of honey had been provided with his toast, and he was dipping a dubious finger into it, wondering whether he ought to try dabbing it into his eye, when at last the flap opened again and his brother was with him. "Did you actually tell me that Ben is dead?" he blurted at once. Hal's face contracted a bit, but his jaw was set. "No," Hal said evenly. "I told you that I'd news of Ben, and they said he was dead. I don't believe it." He gave John a stare, defying him to contradict this belief. "Oh, good," Grey said mildly. "Then I don't believe it either." "Who told you, though?" "That's why I don't believe it," Hal replied, turning to lift the tent flap and peer out, evidently to be sure of not being overheard. And the thought made Grey's belly flutter a little. "It was Ezekiel Richardson who brought me the news. And I wouldn't trust that fellow if he told me I had a hole in the seat of my breeches, let alone something like that." The flutter in Grey's belly became a full-blown beating of wings. "Your instincts haven't led you amiss there," he said. "Sit down and have a piece of toast. I have a few things to tell you." William woke with a shattering headache and the conviction that he had forgotten something important. Clutching his head, he discovered a bandage wound round it, chafing his ear. He pulled it off impatiently. There was blood on it, but not much, and all dried. He recalled vague bits of things from the night before. Pain, nausea, his head swimming. Uncle Hal. And then an image of his father, white-faced and fragile. "If you and I have things to say to each other..." Christ! Had he dreamed that? He said something bad in German, and a young voice repeated it, rather doubtfully.
"What's that mean, sir?"
asked Zeb, who had popped up beside his cot with a covered tray.
"You don't need to know, and don't repeat it," William said, sitting up.
"What happened to my head?"
Zeb's brow creased.
"You don't remember, sir?"
"If I did, would I be asking you?"
Zeb's brow creased in concentration, but the logic of this question escaped him, and he merely shrugged, set down the tray, and answered the first one.
"Colonel Grey said you was hit on the head by deserters."
"Desert..."
"Oh."
He stopped to consider that.
"British deserters?"
"No."
There was a reason why German profanity had sprung to his mind. He had a fleeting memory of Hessians and...
"And what?" "Colenso's got over the shits," Zeb offered helpfully.
"Good to know the day's starting out well for somebody. Oh, Jesus."
Pain crackled inside his skull, and he pressed a hand to his head.
"Have you got anything to drink on that tray, Zeb?"
"Yes, sir."
Zeb uncovered the tray triumphantly, revealing a dish of coddled eggs with toast, a slice of ham, and a beaker of something that looked suspiciously murky, but smelled strongly of alcohol.
"What's in this?"
"Dunno, sir. But Colonel Grey says It's a hair of the dog what bit you sort of thing.
Oh.
So it hadn't been a dream.
He shoved that thought aside for the moment and regarded the beaker with a cautious interest. He'd had the first of his father's restoratives when he was 14 and had mistaken the punch being prepared for Lord John's dinner party as the same sort that ladies had at garden parties. He'd had a few more in the years since, and found them invariably effective, if rather startling to drink.
"Right, then," he said, and taking a deep breath, picked up the beaker and drained it, swallowing heroically without pausing for breath.
"Caw," said Zeb, admiring. "The cook said he could send some sausages. Was you up to eating them?"
William merely shook his head, being momentarily incapable of speech, and picked up a piece of toast, which he held for a moment, not quite ready to consider actually inserting it into his mouth. His head still hurt, but the restorative had jarred loose a few more bits from the detritus in his brain.
"Advice. You're too old to be given it, and too young to take it."
"Er spricht Deutsch, Herr Gerhardt."
"He speaks German," he heard.
"I heard," he said slowly.
"What did I hear?"
Zeb appeared to think this another rhetorical question, and instead of trying to answer it, asked one of his own.
"What happened to Goth, sir?"
His thin face was solemn, as though he expected to receive bad news.
"Goth?" William repeated blankly. "Has something happened to Goth?"
"Well, he's gone, sir," Zeb said, apparently trying to be tactful. "That is, when the regulars took you, and the Indian, away from the rebels, you wasn't on him."
"When the..."
"What Indian?
What the devil happened yesterday, Zeb?"
"How would I know?" Zeb said, affronted. "Wasn't there, was I?"
"No, of course. Bloody hell.
Is my uncle, the Duke of Pardlo, in camp? I need to talk to him." Zeb looked dubious.
"Well, I can go and look for him, I suppose."
"Do, please. Now."
William waved him off, then sat still for a moment, trying to stick the jagged fragments of his memory back together.
"Rebels?
Goth."
He did recall something about Goth, but what was it? Had he run into rebels who took the horse? But what was this about Indians and deserters? And why did he keep hearing echoes of German speech at the back of his brain? And who, come to think of it, was the Colonel Grey that Zeb had referred to? He'd assumed it was Uncle Hal. But his father's rank was Lieutenant Colonel, and he'd also be addressed as Colonel in common use. He glanced at the tray and the empty beaker. Uncle Hal certainly knew about the hair of the dog, but...
"As long as you're alive, everything's all right."
He put the untouched toast down, a sudden lump in his throat. Again. He had the lump last night when he saw Papa. When he'd said to his father,
"Yes, God damn it, his father,
I'm glad you're not dead." He maybe wasn't quite ready to talk to Papa, or Papa to him. And he didn't quite agree that everything was all right, but... A shaft of brilliant sunlight lanced into his face as the tent flap was shoved aside, and he sat bolt upright, swinging his legs out of bed to be ready to meet. But it wasn't either his uncle or his father who appeared out of the eye-watering blur of sunlight. It was Bannister Tarleton, in uniform, but wigless and unbuttoned, looking indecently cheerful for someone whose face seemed to have been beaten badly not too long ago.
"Alive, are you, Ellesmere?"
Ban spotted the dish, and scooping up a coddled egg in his fingers, gulped it. He licked his buttery fingers, making pleased noises.
"Christ, I'm hungry. Been up since dawn. Killing on an empty stomach leaves you rare sharp set, I'll say that. Could I have the rest?"
"Be my guest.
Who have you been killing for breakfast?"
"Rebels."
Tarleton looked surprised, arrested with a mouthful of toast. He chewed this imperfectly and bolted the bite before answering with a shower of crumbs.
No. Washington's troops withdrew to the south, so far as I know. Hessian deserters. The same lot that crowned you and left you for dead, or so I assume. They had your horse. Recognized him.
He reached for another egg, and William thrust a spoon into his hand.
For God's sake, eat like a Christian.
Do you have my horse?
I do. He's lame in the right fore, but I don't think it's bad. Hmm. Have you got your own cook?
No. He's my uncle's. Tell me about the deserters. They knocked me on the head, and my memory's a bit spotty. More than a bit, but chunks of it were beginning to come back pretty fast now. Between bites, Tarleton gave him the story. A company of mercenaries under von Knyphausen had made up their minds to desert during the battle, but not all the men were of the same mind. Those in favour of desertion had drawn away a bit, and were quietly discussing whether it was necessary to kill the dissenters, when William had shown up unexpectedly in their midst.
That knocked them a bit skewways, as you might surmise. Tarleton, having finished the eggs and most of the toast, picked up the beaker and looked disappointed at finding it empty.
There's probably water in that canteen, William said, motioning toward the battered tin and leather object hanging from the tent pole.
So that's it.
They looked a bit nervous, but when I asked one of them in German whether there was a farrier nearby, that was it. Gough threw a shoe. That's why he... But then I heard someone whispering, sounding frantic, and he was saying, he heard, he knows. Must have meant he thought I'd overheard them plotting and knew what they were up to. He breathed out in relief at having this much of the previous day restored to him. Tarleton nodded.
Imagine so. They did kill some of the dissenters. Gatherer Barney broke out after they bashed you on the head and threw you into the ravine. But not all of them.
A few of the mercenaries had escaped and headed for von Knyphausen, who, upon hearing the news, had sent a dispatch to Clinton asking for assistance in dealing with the miscreants. William nodded at this. It was always better to have matters like desertion or treason dealt with by troops outside the affected companies. And knowing Ban Tarleton, he would have leapt at the chance to track down the deserters and...
Were you told to kill them?
He asked, striving for casualness. Tarleton gave him an eggy grin and wiped a few lingering crumbs off his chin.
Not specifically. Got the impression that as long as I brought a few back to tell the tale, no one much cared how many. And there was a hint of pour encourager les autres in my orders.
Politely suppressing his shock at the revelation that Tarleton could read, let alone read Voltaire, William nodded.
I see. My orderly said something rather curious. Mentioned that I'd been found by rebels.
With an Indian?
Do you know anything about that?
Tarleton looked surprised, but shook his head.
Not a thing. Oh.
He sat down on the stool and now rocked back a little, hands clasped about one knee, looking pleased with himself.
I do know something, though. Recall you asked me about Harkness?
Harkness? Oh, yes. William's exclamation had less to do with mention of Captain Harkness and more to do with the important thing he'd forgotten, which had just come back to him, Jane and her sister. He had an immediate impulse to get up and go find her, make sure they were all right. The fugitive loyalist and camp followers would have been well clear of the actual battle, of course, but the violence and agitation that attended fighting didn't simply stop when the fighting did. And it wasn't only deserters and scavengers who looted, raped, and hunted among the hapless sheep. He spared a flickering thought for Anne Endicott and her family, but they did at least have a man to protect them, however ill-equipped. Jane and Fanny. But surely Zeb would have known, if anything.
What?
He looked blankly at Tarleton.
What did you say?
That knock on the head affected your hearing too, did it?
Ban took a swig from the canteen.
I said I made inquiries. Harkness never joined his regiment. For all anyone knows, he's still in Philadelphia.
William's mouth felt dry. He reached for the canteen and took a swallow. The water was warm and tin-tasting, but wet.
Absent without leave, do you mean?
Very much without leave, Tarleton assured him. Last anyone recalls seeing him, he was promising to go back to some brothel and give some whore a proper seeing to. Maybe she saw to him instead.
He laughed heartily at the thought. William stood up abruptly, then, for something to do, reached to replace the canteen on its nail. The tent flap was down, but a stray beam of dust-filled sunlight still fell through the gap, catching the glitter of metal. His officer's gorget hung from the nail, its silver gleaming in the sun.
Percival Wainwright?
John hadn't seen Hal so disconcerted since the events concerning their father's death, which had also involved Percy, come to think of it.
In the very fashionable flesh, he's apparently an advisor to the Marquis de Lafayette.
Who's that?
A flash young frog with a lot of money, Gray said with a one-shouldered shrug. Rebel general, said to be very close to Washington.
Close, Hal repeated with a sharp look at Gray. Close to Wainwright, too, do you think?
Probably not that way, he replied calmly, though his heart beat a little faster.
I gather you're not altogether surprised that he isn't dead.
Percy, I mean.
He was vaguely affronted. He'd gone to a lot of trouble to make it appear that Percy had died in prison while awaiting trial for sodomy.
Hal merely snorted. Men like that never die so conveniently. Why the bloody hell is he telling you this, do you think?
Gray suppressed the vivid memory of bergamot, red wine, and pettigrain.
I don't know, but I do know he's deeply involved with French interests, and Wainwright's never been involved with any interests other than his own,
Hal interrupted brusquely.
He gave John a sharp look.
You'd do well to remember that.
I doubt I shall ever see the fellow again,
John replied, overlooking the implication that his brother considered him gullible, or worse. He was entirely aware that while Hal was treating Richardson's news of Ben with scorn, and was very likely right to do so, neither of them could completely ignore the possibility that the man had been telling the truth. Hal verified this assumption by smacking his fist down on the campaign chest, making the pewter cups jump and fall over. He stood abruptly.
Bloody hell, he muttered.
Stay here.
Where are you going?
Hal paused at the tent flap for an instant. His face was still haggard, but John recognized the battle light in his eyes.
To arrest Richardson.
You can't arrest him yourself, for God's sake.
Gray was on his feet, too, reaching for Hal's sleeve.
Which regiment does he belong to?
The 5th. But he's detached.
I told you he was an intelligencer, did I not?
The word intelligencer dripped with contempt.
All right. I'll speak to Sir Henry first.
John had got a grip on Hal's arm and tightened his hold at this.
I should have thought you'd had enough of scandal by now, he said, trying for calmness. Take a breath and imagine what will likely happen if you do that. Assuming that Sir Henry would take the time to consider your request. Today, for God's sake.
He could hear the army moving outside. There was no danger of pursuit from Washington's troops, but Clinton wasn't going to hang about. His division, with its baggage and refugees under its wing, would be on the road within the hour. Hal's arm was hard as marble under John's hand and stayed that way. But he did stop, breathing with a slow, deep regularity. At last, he turned his head and looked into his brother's eyes. A beam of sunlight threw every line in his face into stark relief.
Name
"One thing you think I wouldn't do," he said quietly, "in order not to have to tell Minnie that Ben is dead?"
Gray took one long, deep breath of his own and nodded, letting go.
"Point taken. Whatever you mean to do, I'll help. But first I have to find William. What Percy said, ah."
Hal blinked, and his face relaxed a fraction.
"Yes, of course. Meet you here in half an hour."
William had barely finished dressing before the message he'd been halfway expecting arrived from Sir Henry, delivered by Lieutenant Foster, whom he knew slightly. Foster grimaced sympathetically when handing it over. William observed Sir Henry Clinton's personal seal. Not a good sign. On the other hand, if he was to be arrested for being absent without leave the previous day, Harry Foster would have brought an armed escort and taken him off without a by your leave. That was mildly heartening, and he broke the seal without hesitation. In the event, it was a terse note, advising him that he was relieved of duty until further notice, but that was all. He exhaled, only then realizing that he'd been holding his breath.
But of course Sir Henry wouldn't imprison him. How and where? With the army on the move? Short of putting him in irons and transporting him by wagon.
Realistically, Clinton couldn't even confine him to quarters. The quarters in question were beginning to shake overhead as his uncle's orderly set to dismantling the tent.
All right, then. He stuffed the note into his pocket, stuffed his feet into his boots, seized up his hat, and went out, feeling not that bad, all things considered. He had a headache, but it was bearable, and he'd managed to eat what breakfast Tarleton had left.
When things settled down, and Sir Henry got round to taking official notice of his disobedience of orders, William could fish up Captain André and have him explain about going to find Tarleton, and all would be well. Meanwhile, he'd go down to the camp followers area and find Jane. There was a strong, bitter smell of fresh cabbage floating over the sprawl of makeshift shelters and human detritus, and a scatter of farm wagons drawn up along the road, with women crowding round them. The army cooks fed the refugees, but rations were sparse and had doubtless been disrupted by the battle. He walked along the road, keeping an eye out for Jane or Fanny, but didn't spot either one. His eye attuned for a young girl, though. He did see Peggy Endicott trudging down the road with a bucket in either hand.
"Miss Peggy, may I offer my assistance, ma'am?"
He smiled down at her and was warmed to see her own face, somewhat anxious before, bloom into delight under her cap.
"Captain," she cried, nearly dropping her buckets in her excitement. "Oh, I'm so happy to see you. We were all so worried for you, you know, in the battle, and we all said a prayer for your safety. But Papa told us you would surely prevail over the wicked rebels, and God would see you safe."
"Your lovely prayers were to great effect," he assured her gravely, taking the buckets. One was full of water, and the other of turnips, their green tops wilting over the rim. "Are your mamma and papa well, then, and your sisters?"
They walked along together, Peggy dancing on her toes and chattering like an affable small parrot. William kept an eye peeled for Jane or Fanny among the laundresses. It was safer near those redoubtable ladies than in some other parts of the camp. There were no kettles boiling this morning, of course, but the scent of lye soap floated on the humid air like scum on a cauldron full of dirty clothes. There was no sign of Jane and Fanny by the time he'd reached the Endicott's wagon, still on all four wheels.